Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And this is episode number 154, where we are finally, talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, season 2, episode 8, the finale. This is the second time we've recorded in like 4 days, so I'm pretty proud of us for that.
Yeah, we're getting it done.
How's your cold wrapping up? Do you feel, I feel like you were clearing your throat earlier. It's still lingering, isn't it?
Yeah, I've still got this, like, I think it's just all the weather changes. Like, like Sunday and Monday, it's supposed to be 60 and 70.
I know, isn't that nuts?
Like, and it's been like 30 and 40 and, you know, last week it was 20 degrees. You know, I think it's just all the ups and downs. I think I always feel this way around this kind of time of year. So it's like, yeah, but no, I've still got a little bit of a cough and just a little bit of like gunk that is just like throat clearing, you know, just have to keep it moving. Eventually it will disappear, but
yeah.
So still a little bit on the mend, but generally I feel normal and everything's back to normal. So
that's good. If I sound sick, I'm not. I'm apparently allergic to pineapples, my favorite fruit in the world. So that's cool.
That's really, really sad.
I've suspected it for a while because I would eat pineapple and then like, I mean, I feel like pineapple kind of burns for everybody, right? Because it's like acidic.
Like it has a little bit of a, it doesn't burn, but it always makes my mouth itch just a little bit.
Yeah. And I've heard that like pineapples have like the histamines, like the things, like it kind of, your body thinks that it's pollen essentially.
Well, it's supposed to also be good for like sore throats because like it has like bromine that breaks up coughs and it's like a natural, But yeah, it does have all that stuff in it that can like trigger all kinds of responses and whatnot.
Yeah. So like the last time I ate some, it kind of, I had like a slight reaction to it. This time when I ate some and I've been cooking with it in the slow cooker, I've been sneezing a bunch. My nose is itchy. My throat is kind of scratchy, itchy. And I'm really sad because I love pineapple.
Yeah, it's my favorite. I would be absolutely distraught if it got worse.
I'm going to eat it anyway. What's it going to do? Kill me?
What if you just take some Claritin before you eat pineapple?
So that's the thing is like I've never had allergies in. Well, when I was a kid, I think I was allergic to like dust, basically. But like I grew out of that and haven't had any food allergies or anything, which I love to eat. So like very grateful for that. And Kevin, it seems like, is allergic to everything. I don't think he has food allergies, but he has a lot of like cats, pollen, dust, like dust mites. Like, you know, he's always had to deal with that. And so I was like complaining when he got home and I was like, oh, you live like this all the time. This is awful. And he's like, yeah, it is. Did you take any allergy medication? And I was like, oh, I forgot that was a thing that existed. So I did take some of his allergy meds and I do feel like it's kicking in a little bit. So maybe by the end of this, I won't feel or sound quite so bad.
Yeah. Understandable. I want to share a picture with you. I'll show Karen. So my husband is addicted to estate auctions online. He's addicted. He loves them. And so he usually is looking for Lego, but he has a bad habit of buying other things while looking for Lego. I just added it to the doc. It's not that exact one. This is from an Etsy listing, but it looks like that. It's shaped like that with the basket and it just has different colored glass. He came across this in an auction and he goes, Kristen, would you be okay if I bid on this? And I was like, yes, that's so cool. And he won it. And he went and picked it up this morning because it was from a local one.
Okay.
And it's now plugged in on our entry table and it's so cute.
For everybody who can't see it, it looks like a hot air balloon table lamp
with a little basket.
Yeah. It, oh and my gosh. It's got
like stained glass on the balloon. It's so cool.
What I put colors it in the dock, so we'll have to.
It's got a lot of red, but it's like, there's more of like a multitude of colors. So it's kind of like blue, red, green. And it's got more of the spotting that you sometimes see in stained glass. So it's got like a little more variation to the colors.
Yeah.
I'll have to take a picture of the one we got.
Yes.
And maybe we can include it in the show notes, because I absolutely am in love with it. And it's the highlight of my day.
Yeah, I really love that. That is so cool. I used to go to estate auctions and stuff and buy things and resell them. My boss, you know, is the one who spent the money, but I helped her do that. And it was honestly one of my favorite things I've ever done in my life. And I really miss it. And like, I was just at the antique store the other day and I was like, man, I miss like buying out like a box full of old jewelry and piecing it out one by one and seeing if you've got any like secret hits in there and stuff like that. Oh, it's so cool.
You know, my husband keeps buying things like giant lots of baseball cards that we now have to sort through and see if we can find any winners. If there's one or two winners, it'll be worth it. I think he spent $20 on this whole collection. It's a ton of them.
Wow.
But we have yet to start that process.
Hey, if you ever want anybody to help, I love doing that kind of stuff.
We may need assistance at one point or another. I will definitely keep you in mind because, yeah, we've still got two antique clocks that he bought from the last one that there is a clockmaker nearby that we need to go and like take them to. We just haven't made it there yet. But yeah, so it's fun. I will say it's a lot of fun, but
yeah,
he just comes home with bins full of stuff and I'm like, what are we doing with this?
I love that. But I love that.
He loves
for you.
It so much. Yeah. He loves it. So
I'm not jealous at all. It's fine. What does Kevin collect? He wishes he could collect reptiles.
Ohio State t-shirts.
I mean, that is 50% of his wardrobe.
I mean, that's that any of those him. That's any of those football Ohio State football boys.
Yeah, but you know, it's probably better that he doesn't collect anything because I do enough collecting for the both of us. So, and if he wants to collect reptiles, I'm not going to be mad about it. Still asking him when we're going to get a hognose snake because I really want one of them.
There you go. Yeah. Just have your own little reptile house in the basement.
That would be terrariums. Really cool. Yeah. I went and picked up crickets for Petey today. And I was reading in the living room and I was like, do we have an animal in the house? Because I kept hearing this like scurrying or something like that. And then I realized it was the crickets moving around inside the bag that I had put on the entertainment stand. And I was so mad because I hate crickets, but I love Petey. So,
yep. We used to have to buy them. One of our teachers in grade school had an iguana. And they would buy crickets for the iguana to hunt. And yeah, that was always fun.
Yeah. Petey's pretty dumb. Kevin has a picture of him with a roach literally sitting on his head because, and he's like, where did it go? So love Petey, but he is empty head.
He's cute.
Yeah, exactly. What else is he good for? That's about it. If you would like to talk to us about whatever you're addicted to collecting, whether you developed allergies late in life, Percy Jackson, or anything else, really, you can contact us at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Instagram or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. And we are not doing a news and updates section this week.
Still.
Because,
sorry.
Yeah. Because we just recorded and we plan on doing a news episode anyway. And we figured, hey, let's just get right to the finale.
Exactly. Yeah. So we will touch on all the fun news. And if there's anything you think we need to know for sure, feel free to send it to us because we'll definitely include it in the news roundup. So
I also did see some of the casting news and there is somebody that I cannot wait to talk about. So
yeah. Yeah. It's going to be fun.
Yes.
Okay. So until then, today we are talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, season 2, episode 8. The Fleece Works Its Magic Too Well. So the episode opens with the knight on Half-Blood Hill. The knight with Thalia and Luke and Grover and Annabeth all trying to get to camp for the first time. And it's kind of like this, they're setting the stage for this is what everyone remembers. Mm-hmm. So like it's just the beginning of what happened on the hill that night. And it's what Thalia, as much as we know, she remembers, plus Luke and Annabeth and Grover, like they remember Thalia saying she would protect them. They run off and then she's a tree. So that's all any of them really know. And then we skip very quickly to Percy sitting shotgun in the car with Annabeth, Grover, and Tyson in the back seat. And he is staring out the window in his own little world, hearing Annabeth's voice recite the description of the Great Prophecy. So not the word-for-word version he was hearing from Kronos just an episode ago, but just the description of it, just talking about how a child of the eldest three, upon reaching 16 years old, will decide the fate of Olympus, and it will be a single choice that either saves the age of the gods or destroys it. And he, you can tell, is just running through his head everything he knows about Thalia, because at the end of the last episode, Annabeth was talking about how much she was looking forward to the fleece bringing Thalia back and how Thalia was going to be on their side. And Percy was already starting to have doubts, you could tell, about whether she would in fact be on their side or not. And so, yeah, all of this is just racing through his head as they're driving toward camp.
And it really sucks for him because he hears how excited Annabeth and Grover are to get their friend back. And he has such a bad feeling about it. And you can tell he doesn't want to say anything and doesn't want to like crush them in this their moment of excitement. But he also cannot just ignore what he's seen in his dreams.
Exactly. Like there's too many things that are pointing to what will she be doing? Like, you know, what is Thalia's goal? Why is she the tree? How does she feel about it? All of that. Like, there's just so much racing through his head that he just doesn't really know. And I think that's fair. At least he's giving himself the option of it could go either way. Like, he's preparing himself for she could choose Annabeth and be on our side, or she could choose Luke or choose neither. And, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities for what Thalia will do. So all of a sudden, slams on the brakes. It's because there is a blackjack in the middle of the road. I was going to say there's a black horse. Then I was like, no, it's a black Pegasus. And I was like, no, his name is Blackjack. So
yeah.
So a wild blackjack appears and Percy looks at his mom and goes, it's okay. I know him. And gets out of the car.
Great line.
And I don't know if his I know him or her going, he knows him, is better. Because her response to that just cracks me up every time. Just, yeah, he knows him. It's fine. Like, my kid's like, talking to a horse. It's good.
She's trying so hard to be normal about it. But she is removed from a lot of the weirdness. Not all of it, but a lot of the weirdness that happens to him. And she still kind of has to, like, wrap her head around it when she comes face to face with it. And the fact that he just gets out of the car and starts like gesticulating, like you can tell he's talking to Blackjack and like, what are you doing here, buddy? Like, oh God.
Where's Clarice? So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I can only imagine being one step removed from everything. Like Sally knows about the Minotaur. She saw the Minotaur. Sally knows about what happened last year and that they went to, you know, like she knows intellectually about all of it, but like she didn't necessarily experience everything. So hearing it all from him, it must just sound absolutely insane. And now to just see part of it in front of her again, it's like, oh yeah, that is all real. Like, that isn't just my kid with a very strong imagination. Like this is all part of his world. And she acknowledges that too.
And I do feel like there is a difference between seeing a Pegasus and then acknowledging the fact that your kid can talk to the Pegasus. Like,
yeah,
those like things existing? For me. Cool. Yeah, it's a horse with wings. It's not that weird. My son telepathically communicating to said horse with wings. That's a step over the line. You know what I mean?
A little further, just a step further. Sally then gets out of the car. Percy says it's okay. He lets everyone know, like, Clarice didn't make it to the tree, but she's on foot and she's, you know, we got to help her. And so everybody gets out of the car, and Sally included, starts following, you know, Tyson toward the woods. And Percy's like, what are you doing? And they have a little moment, the two of them. And Percy reminds her that, like, you know, it wasn't too long ago, not far from here, that I lost you to a Minotaur and you went to the underworld and I had to go find you. And I can't do that again. Mm-hmm. So, like, please just stay out of harm's way and let me do this. And she agrees to let him do it. And then she notices that there's this like lingering thing on his face. And she goes, tell me what's going on. And he relays to her that he thinks that her dream about the spinning drachma isn't about two sides of him. It's about him and Thalia, that the trident on one side is him, and that the other side, which I believe is a scythe, is representing Thalia, and how they are possibly two sides of the same coin. And like, what does that mean? So, you know, they kind of have a moment and talk about it. And, you know, she says, do what you got to do. I understand, like, be prepared for all of it. Just, you know, take it one step at a time and see how it goes. And so she stays behind and they trudge off into the woods to go see how they can help.
This scene made me so like immediately emotional, because you can tell both Sally and Percy are just trying to protect each other. And it's, you know, it's such a natural instinct for Sally because she's the mother. And it's kind of funny, like this was something that came up recently for me, because my mom and I are like super, super close. And I was telling her, like, I'm sad because my dad died and like, I'm still dealing with that. And like, it's weird and stuff like that. And she's like, don't let it be sad. Like, it's okay. And I'm like, she loves being a mom and she is a great mom. And every part of her is like, let me just fix this for you. Let me just make sure that you're not in pain, that everything's going to be okay. And I really thought about that when Sally was talking to Percy, because she just wants to protect him. She just wants to be there to throw herself in front of the Minotaur, literally, in order to save him. And the thing is, like, with kids, whether they're, what, 13 or 37, they have to forge their own path and make their own mistakes and fail and choose to get up and keep going and stuff. And, you know, with my dad, like, I'm going to be sad. Like, there's nothing I can do to get around that. And it was a really kind of awesome conversation to have with my mom, where I was just like, I appreciate you wanting to make sure that like, I'm not in pain, but like, that's just a part of life. And I feel like Percy kind of was having the same conversation with his mom, going, I know you just want to protect me, but this is literally my job. This is like literally what I'm made for. Like, his reactions are going to be faster than hers. He's used to dealing with monsters and all these other mythological creatures and stuff. And how difficult must it have been for Sally to be like, okay, I'll stay here. You go save the world. Call me when you're done.
Right? When you need a ride.
Yeah.
I'm here. Yeah. Yeah. It's why she's the best. It's why she's so important to the show. And yeah, why I'm so glad that they're continuing to find ways to keep her involved, because she really is.
Definitely.
Just fantastic. Okay. So then we cut back at camp. We are in the Hippodrome. And there's some cleanup going on. I was still trying to figure out if this is supposed to be cleanup from like the Great Chariot Race that they just had and they're still cleaning it up.
I think so.
Or if they're cleaning up, because they also talk about monsters having been in camp, like on campgrounds and things. So I was curious if like it might be a little bit of everything, where there's just, you know, they're just in a constant state of cleanup because things keep going wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah. So all the kids are trying to clean up, pick up debris and whatnot. And Tantalus is using his big old like amplifying horn to annoy them as they do so. And we see Chris Rodriguez and a handful of other campers come up to complain to Tantalus that the borders are basically unprotected for, you know, 80% of them or whatever. And how things keep getting through and they need to do more. And, you know, he's basically yelling at Tantalus. And Tantalus is ranting back at him and reaches down and picks up a chicken leg and is able to hold it. And he freaks out. He's like, yes, the gods, you know, they've released my curse. Like, he's so excited. And then he gets annihilated by a fireball. And it's glorious.
Perfect. First of all, he was so insufferable. Like, that story he was telling all of them, it just made me want to throttle him. And I just would love to imagine that amidst all of the chaos and amidst, like, Zeus keeping an eye on everyone and everything and trying to figure out what's going on, he's like, wait a second, Tantalus is about to die. Let's just mess with him for a second. Let's just let him pick up the chicken leg and then he can die, you know? And like yeah, like, oh God, he's so petty. And I kind of love it. But also, and I don't think we mentioned this like this season, but in case anybody has forgotten, the reason why Tantalus is cursed like this is because he tried to feed his child to the gods.
Yeah.
He like cut him up, stewed him, gave him to the gods. And that's why he's not allowed to eat anything ever again. So like, he kind of deserves all of this. I didn't really feel
the crime. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't really feel too bad for him, to be honest.
No, this is hilarious. And yeah, well worth, it was a perfect moment. Perfect moment. So we kind of cut away from that area to the edge of camp to where the tree is. And we see that camp has been enduring with Laestrygonians hurling fireballs at the barrier. And we see Percy, Tyson, Annabeth, and Grover watching Laestrygonians hurling fireballs at it, but they're outside camp. So they're watching from behind as camp's kind of being attacked. And while they're there, Tyson feels like the earth rumbling beneath his feet, and the others can't really sense it. But, you know, we all know Tyson is way more sensitive to that sort of stuff. And a moment later, Luke and his forces arrive via a caravan of random vehicles. There's a van, there's a truck, there's all kinds of random stuff. And we watch them kind of pile out, and we learn as he's addressing them, and Tyson is listening in and relaying it to our squad, that there is a team inside camp that's been helping Luke to get monsters into campgrounds and do damage. So, like, that's a red flag. Like, someone in camp is allowing these monsters to come in and do that. And that's, yeah, concerning, because we're going to have to figure that out before the end. He specifically says, we will burn camp to the ground and anyone left inside. Luke says this. And when he does, the look Annabeth gets on her face is interesting, because it's like, she has to believe that he's still savable, like he's not gone. But stuff like this, when he's saying things like that and has turned the corner on, we're going to protect them, anyone who doesn't try to stop us will be spared, like, he's not using that rhetoric anymore. He's now just saying, we're burning it down, everyone's done, you know, this is, we just have to wipe camp out and we can move on. And it's something inside her kind of clicked. I don't think it was a total give up on her part, but she's starting to realize that Luke is farther gone than she initially imagined.
Yeah, that's exactly how I was going to describe it, because some of his actions you can excuse, right? Because he believes that he's doing the right thing. And he's talked before about how he doesn't want to hurt fellow demigods. He wants to save them from the tyranny of the Olympians. Now, the inexcusable thing prior to this was he basically didn't have an answer about what that would mean for mortals. And, you know, that's a pretty awful thing too. But this is yet another direct sort of line to, okay, he's like, he's kind of evil at this point. Like, these are his friends. These are the people that spent every day with for years, and he's just willing to let them die because they refuse to join his army. Like, yeah, I think that in this moment Annabeth feels a huge betrayal.
Yeah, definitely. And you can see it on her face. It hits her that, like, this isn't necessarily the same Luke that she knows. Like, this isn't, he's definitely turned a corner. Unsavable? I don't think she's gotten that far yet, but
yeah, I think she's gonna hold out hope for him for a really, I mean, we know, but yes. You know, she is gonna hold out hope for him for a really long time, because there's always gonna be a part of her who remembers the old Luke and everything that he did for her. That is a very difficult thing to give up on.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Luke does draw a line for his troops and says that they have to free Thalia from the tree before any damage comes to it, or to, you know, like, they can kill whomever, burn whatever, but the tree has to stand until they can free her from it. And it made me wonder, is that like a Luke requirement, or was that a Kronos requirement? Because last we saw, Luke was talking to Kronos, and he was upset with Kronos because Kronos didn't tell him that Thalia could be saved with the fleece from the tree. And that's when Kronos did the little, like, mind melty thing where it gave him, like, a migraine or whatever. So I'm curious if this is a Luke requirement. Like, we're saving Thalia because I believe she's going to be on our side. And, you know, Kronos just is allowing him to go through with that. Or does Kronos know something that, you know, that we don't know, that she will, in fact, be on Luke's side?
I do kind of think that this is coming from Kronos, just because Percy walked away from him in the middle of the Great Prophecy and took the fleece. And so I think he's kind of given up on Percy. He wants Luke to kill Percy. And so if he wants Luke to kill Percy, who does that leave? Well, as far as we're concerned, as far as we know, it only leaves Thalia. So I do think that, I think this is one of those times where, like, they're aligning. Like, Luke never wanted to really hurt Thalia to begin with. You know, he hurt the tree because he didn't know that she was actually inside. He had to believe that she was dead and gone, and that the tree was just a tree. Now that he knows Thalia is there and can be saved, and Kronos has given up on Percy, they're back on the same track again. So
worth a thought. That's, I definitely agree with you, though. It probably is coming from Kronos, but it's also what Luke wants too. So their interests are aligned at the moment. Okay, so next we kind of pop away to a different area of woods around camp, and Clarice is racing through. She still has the golden fleece in her arms, so she hasn't made it to the tree yet. But she has crossed the border into camp because other campers are, like, coming up on her. And we quickly realize that it is Chris Rodriguez and his crew. And at first, that feels, you know, comforting. But in another few minutes, that gets a little more complicated. So we'll get back to that.
Yeah.
I'm doing my best to go chronological, by the way, guys. So it may jump around a little bit, but I feel like it's the only way to really handle this episode. So apologies if it seems a little scattered every now and then. So we jump back to our crew, to Percy and Annabeth and Grover and Tyson. And Percy and Annabeth have kind of stepped away, and they're having a brief discussion about Thalia's possible loyalties. Annabeth is decided that she will be on her side. And Percy very skillfully navigates mentioning to Annabeth that he is not certain that Thalia will be on their side. He does it in such a way, in such a very calm, collected way, that it doesn't really raise Annabeth's hackles. She doesn't feel like he's attacking her friend. He's just merely trying to prepare her for the possibility that Thalia may not say, oh, yeah, defend the gods, save the gods, which is fair.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're absolutely right. He did this so skillfully, because he basically says, so you think that Thalia is going to be on your side because she's your friend? And Annabeth is like, yeah, absolutely. And he goes, she was Luke's friend too. And that is such a great line, because to the audience as well, it's sort of like, yeah, Annabeth may be, you know, the smartest demigod there, but she is blinded sometimes by not only her hubris, which I think is a part of this, but just she has such a strong belief in Thalia. And like, hey, we know that she's right, but Percy doesn't at this moment. And there's every bit of a chance that she might side with Luke because she knew Luke longer. And they were both not adults, but like teenagers at the same time. Annabeth was a child, you know? You have a different relationship with somebody half your age than you do somebody who's your peer. So there is a good chance that Thalia might side with Luke. And I like that you mentioned that Percy did it in a way that didn't raise her hackles.
And it's also worth noting that Annabeth would have more of a hero worship kind of, like that would be her memories of Thalia are, she's my friend. She's awesome. She's going to save us. It's going to be fine. Like it, because of how young Annabeth was, that would be how she'd remember Thalia. Because when you're younger, you think very well of the people older than you and the people you look up to. So it makes total sense that she does not doubt it, but I'm glad that Percy is able to just, again, very calmly kind of put the seed in her mind that this is not a done deal. We're hoping that's what happens, but like, we can't count on that yet. And just a quick scene with them, but honestly, a really powerful one and a necessary one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So they are kind of planning what they're going to do next, and they are tromping through the woods, and Percy and crew come up against a pretty large contingent of armed campers. Percy pretty quickly realizes that they're outnumbered and that surrendering to them and being taken to who he assumes is Tantalus in charge of camp protection, being taken to Tantalus is like the best move here. And so he surrenders, they all surrender, and they say, you know, take us to your leader, basically, which is not Tantalus anymore. As we know, we learned pretty quickly that it's Mr. D, which is just fantastic.
Yeah.
So they take them to Mr. D in the big house, where he is regaling campers with song. I believe is the ukulele or guitar? I think it's a ukulele.
Yeah.
He's just kind of strumming and being ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, you know, he tries to get the message across to Mr. D that, like, this is life and death here. Luke and his forces are on the border. They are ready to challenge. And, like, they're demigods, so they're going to be allowed to cross the border. There's nothing stopping them. So, like, we have to be ready to fight here. Like, let's go. And Mr. D could care less. And, you know, he kind of mentions, like, you know, he is technically a god, and he can't, there's only so much he can really do. And that's when Percy kind of steps up and decides to rally the troops himself. And he makes the announcement that Kronos is back, and everybody gasps. And Mr. D, I believe, is like, that's not true. Or like, you don't know, something close to that. And Percy continues to go on and address the room and just let them know that, like, they have to save themselves. Nobody's coming. Nobody's, you know, there's no hero ready to step in. They are the heroes, and they need to go stand up for themselves and protect their home. And now's the time. And it's a rousing speech, but honestly, it's very unrehearsed. It doesn't feel overly planned. And I love that, because Percy is such a new, he's so new to this, that I love that it just feels like, I just need to get him energized. Like, I just need him to get ready to, like, go to the border and do a little fighting. Like, we can do this. It's not saving the world yet. It's just saving camp. We can do this.
Yeah, I agree. When I first saw this, and even the subsequent times that I watched it, I was like, man, the speech is like a little cringy. But I kind of now, especially now that I've heard Walker talk about it, I do feel like part of that is on purpose. And I think you're right. I think there's a raw sort of unrehearsed element to it, where he's desperate to get people to join him because he know he can't do it by himself. Most of these people think he betrayed camp. Most of them barely know him, don't even really like him. You know, he has like three friends at camp, if you count his brother. And, you know, he's never had an easy time there, despite the fact that he succeeded in his quest last year. And I really, and we could talk about this more when we get to the podcast, but I really like this idea that, like, this is just the beginning of Percy Jackson, the hero, where this is a little bit of a rawer version of him that isn't quite as polished. But when we get to season 5, in which he really does have to get everybody going to fight that final battle, he's probably going to have a bit more of a, you know, as they keep calling it, like a Braveheart moment, where he gets another speech. And I think it'll be rousing. And I think that it will, when we play it next to this one, you'll see how much growth there's been in him.
Yeah, I loved that part of the podcast, and we'll talk about it more when we get there. But yeah, I like that they're acknowledging that Percy has to start somewhere, and that his first attempts at leadership are not going to be eloquent and long-winded, and, you know, like, it's going to be, this is our home, let's protect our home, we've got this, like, you know, all we have to do is go out there and fight and, you know, be the heroes that we need, and ready, let's go, like, that's all they need here. So it was nice to see him take basically a first shot at being the hero without doing too much. So we're going to flip back to another area of the woods. I swear it's just woods, 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 yeah. Camp, woods, camp. Yeah, it's yeah. So a different area of the woods where we've got Clarice and Chris and all of his army minions. I don't know, all the people following him, the campers. And so they're just kind of walking through, trying, obviously making their way toward the tree because she's got the golden fleece. And he warns her about possible traitors, that he thinks that there are, you know, some people who are loyal to Luke in camp. And he points out a young girl in his little group and says, I think she's one of them. And at that moment, he kind of like gives the signal to his campers that, like, now's the time, and they flip, and Clarice very quickly figures out that Chris is actually the traitor. Him and his group here are the ones that have been letting monsters into camp and everything else. And so she fights back, takes a hit from Chris on her upper leg, and runs off toward the hippodrome to escape, to find somewhere to hide or whatever until someone can show up to help her. I was a little confused because I couldn't remember whether Chris was actually one of the traitors or not, but I think you kind of looked into this, right?
Yeah, because I felt the same way. Like, everything I remembered about Chris was from, like, the later books where basically Clarice and him were dating. And, like, I remember something with, like, the labyrinth. And I remember that, like, he wasn't well and she took care of him and, like, they ended up dating and stuff. But I did have to go back to the actual timeline because the first time we see Chris in the books, he's on the Princess Andromeda. So he's already part of Luke's army. And then by the time we get to Titan's Curse, he was sent into the labyrinth in order to find a way into Camp Half-Blood, because this whole, like, end fighting scene also isn't in the book, and they mentioned that, right, on the podcast too. Yeah. And that's where he goes insane from the ghost of King Minos, and then he emerges and eventually, like, Mr. D cures him of his madness and him and Clarice get together and stuff. I still wasn't expecting him to be the one to turn. And I do find it curious that this is kind of the plot, like, this is the way it was taken. But now that I'm thinking about it more, I think it makes more sense to do this than just have him be a random person on the boat that ends up betraying camp, because you can tell Clarice had feelings for him, by the way she was aggressively flirting. And This betrayal right here is way more personal than him just defecting and hanging out with Luke on a ship. So by I'm guessing he will escape and then go through the labyrinth, go insane, and find his way back to camp. And by that time, we're going to have all of this visual history between the two of them in the show. And I think that part will hit harder because of this.
I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense in the book that he's not anybody until he is somebody. But when you're
Yeah.
telling that same story in the physical medium, it will have more impact if it's someone we are aware of who has a name, who we've interacted with at least a few times. Like, it will make more impact then. So, yeah. Okay. So Clarice is on the ground and Chris is over top of her, I believe, with a spear or something at her throat. And he says something like, "Don't you remember you don't have any friends?" And at that moment, Annabeth and Grover come charging in a chariot toward them. Grover grabs the fleece at Annabeth's direction and they charge full speed ahead. Help Clarice get her into the chariot as well, and then charge full speed ahead out of the hippodrome in the mid just in the wood, just go all the way to the edge of camp to Talia's tree.
Yeah.
I loved this whole little scene, just like
It was perfect.
it's hilarious because it's just them in a chariot, like go, like yeah, but it's also like vindication because Clarice did trust them kind of to have her back. I mean, she didn't know they were coming, but like she has friends, and here they are, and they
Yeah.
saved the day. And so,
And I
yeah.
think it's proof to her that she has friends, and that's really important. And I love that not only did they grab the golden fleece, but I mean, she had to run to jump onto the chariot, but they saved her too. You know, it's that same exact thing. Do we go after Annabeth or do we go after the fleece? Do we save the fleece or do we save Clarice? You can do both. And it's been proven time and time again. And yeah, I love this for Clarice. I love the extra stuff that we've been getting. I love that she feels like she has friends now. And the part near the end of the episode was just perfect. And I love everything
Yes.
that's been happening with our character.
Yeah, we will definitely get to that because yeah, it's perfect and I love it so much. Back to the barrier, and I think this is the last flip we make. I'm pretty sure we stay at the barrier until the battle is over now, so you can kind of settle in for the fight sequence. Okay, so the archers that we previously saw have been taken prisoner by Luke and his demigod soldiers because they rushed camp's line and were they outnumbered the archers like by a lot. They are just kind of like walking around like planning what their next move is. Luke is showing his troops how to use like he's using Backbiter but how to help the Laestrygonians cross the barrier so that they can join them to go and burn the rest of camp since that's his evil plan. He is successful in helping one of the giants cross the border, and at that moment Percy, Tyson, and the rest of camp, Percy first, then Tyson, then everyone else, kind of appears on the hillside across from Half Blood Hill, and just you can feel the tension. You can feel that they are ready to defend their home. Percy's rallying cry worked. Congratulations, like mark that one a success. And they're ready to defend camp. And so the battle begins, and I mean, it's a normal battle sequence. No one is pulling punches. You can see the violence and the blood and the gore going on in this battle. It's not them sparring with wooden swords like in first season. It's not even the chariot race where there are some rules and, you know, that sort of thing. This is all out war for camp.
Yeah.
And it's pretty brutal.
I really appreciated the difference in that like face off between them, because when Percy kind of steps up to the plate, which that whole scene was like so cool with him, you think, oh no, did his speech work? He's all by himself. And then Tyson comes up next and like, oh God, Tyson. Oh, I just love him so much. And you know, he's always gonna be next to Percy whenever he can, and I love that. And you can see the sort of like heroic righteousness in Percy's face, you know, he's defending his home. And with that comes a lot of strength of belief in what they're doing. And Luke has that strength of belief too, but I think he's seen some of the cracks in Cronus's facade at this point. And I think he's starting to lose himself to his anger, because as everybody charges past him, you kind of see that anger on his face before he charges, and his eyes are locked on Percy. That is the only person that he wants to get to. And I feel like he's jealous of Percy. He's jealous that, you know, he has, I don't know how much Luke knows, but like Percy has a better relationship with his father, and he kind of, he doesn't like the gods, but he hasn't been warped by them. And Percy is sort of the one that everybody is putting on a pedestal. And not that I think Luke is there for the glory necessarily, but like, I think that he wants to be the hero. He's just the hero on the other side. And I think that pisses him off.
I definitely am with you on that. Yeah. Like, Luke doesn't see himself as the aggressor. He sees himself as the rightful party, which is the mark of any good villain, any good, yeah, you know, anti-hero, basically. And, you know, that you want that quality. You want them to believe that what they're doing is the right thing. But I also think you're right that he's seeing the cracks. Like, it's not a perfect, there's no perfect reasoning for everything he's allowing to happen. And he doesn't really have an explanation for how, you know, what is Cronus going to do to mankind, not just the demigods and all of that. Like, he has reasoned away a lot of that as like, oh, we'll deal with that later. But like, yeah, those are all cracks that he's definitely becoming aware of or is already aware of. And just right now, he's so angry with Percy that he's willing to let whatever else may be coming, he's willing to kind of let it slide. So Luke is definitely looking for Percy as he, you know, comes toward him and the battle begins. He's looking through the fighters for Percy and even calls him out a couple of times. They do actually start to fight each other. And the first, like, notable thing, I would say they're pretty well matched, but Percy does disarm Luke. He manages to get Backbiter out of his hands. And you can see that in Percy's eyes, like, that's what he was going for. Like, Percy's not playing for keeps. He's not trying to kill Luke. He's just trying to stop him so that they can try and talk some sense into him or, you know, figure out what their next move is. Whereas Luke, once he's disarmed, continues to fight and gets a good hit and ends up disarming Percy. And once Percy's disarmed, Luke just starts wailing on him. And this is, I think, where you really start to get the blood and the guts of this, because Percy is spitting up blood. It's rushing out of his nose. He's, you know, he's laying on the ground, like, coughing because of what's just happened. And it gives you a little bit of, like, the realism of this show, because first season was pretty tame. And we know that these books just get a little darker and a little darker and a little darker until we're literally fighting to save the world in the last book. So, like, I think this is a good way to step up the reality of the situation without kind of going too far. And since it is, you know, a family show, a middle grade novel, a kid's show, I'm glad that they are kind of baby stepping toward the bigger battle scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah, the violence of those punches to his face really caught me off guard, because there was so much anger behind it. And it wasn't just that Luke was trying to disarm him. Like, Luke wanted to hurt him. And once he hurts him, then he goes and picks up his sword, intending to kill him. And I think it says so much about both of those characters. Like you were saying, Percy didn't want to kill Luke. He just wanted to disarm him. He just wanted to stop him. There's a reason why there's that phrase, the best defense is a good offense, because all Percy is doing is being defensive. And because the only thing he's doing is being defensive, Luke is able to get the upper hand because he's going in harder. He's the one who is taking those steps with the offense. And yeah, it did kind of shock me to see him hit Percy that hard. But at the same time, you know, we have to show that, yeah, these might be kids, but they are fighting for the world. And they both believe that they're right. And there's, you know, somebody's going to get hurt. So I'm kind of glad that they went in this direction.
Agreed. So Bloody Percy is laying on the ground and Luke comes at him with Backbiter and is ready to kill him, is, you know, bringing the sword down hard. And a gold trident appears to stop Backbiter. And we see Tyson with his fantastic gold trident saving the day. And I could not have been happier. And yeah,
I did let some naughty words fly when I first saw this because I didn't know what was going on. I legitimately thought it was Poseidon at first. And I was like, how could he do this? He's not supposed to interfere, but it is Percy Jackson. He's kind of a special case. And then you look up and see that it's Tyson. And I was like, that is 100 times better than if it was Poseidon, because Tyson is always going to have Percy's back. And Tyson doesn't like violence. Like, Tyson doesn't want to fight. He just wants to tinker with his toys and hang out with his bro and be like, chill. Still
cool stuff.
Yeah. But nobody's going to touch Percy, and he will do what he has to do to protect him. And honestly, I didn't think I could love Tyson anymore, but Daniel Deemer is doing such a good job that I can't believe I'm saying this, but Tyson might be my favorite character in the series.
Ooh.
I mean, I love Percy. I love Annabeth. But there's just something so special about Tyson. And I think they're bringing him to life in such a perfect way that I just keep falling more in love with this character.
You know, it's funny because every podcast episode that people get to talk about Daniel Deemer and Tyson, they're all in love with Tyson's character. Everyone who comes in, if they have a moment to talk about Daniel Deemer, they're just like, yeah, he's the nicest guy and he's doing so well. And like, I just love Tyson. And yeah, like it's, I don't think it's just you. I think this is a very interesting, different take on Tyson. And it's hitting home because it's just so genuine and so real. And it's pure. Okay, so Tyson helps Percy to his feet after basically disarming Luke, like pushing him back. And at that moment, Annabeth, Grover, and Clarice come racing in their chariot over that same hill that Percy and them were just standing on. And Beth gets hit by an arrow from Allison, good old Allison. Their progress is halted. She flies off the chariot. And of course, Grover and Clarice kind of run to tend to her. And Grover still has the fleece. And in order to get the fleece to the tree, because Allison has ordered her men to start hacking away at the tree to cut it down. In order to save the tree, Percy picks up a spear through the fleece and hands it to Clarice and says, finish your quest. Dude, it's such a perfect moment. It's like,
I love it.
He is doubling down on letting her do her thing and giving her what she needs and giving her the glory that she deserves. Because like, she has done her quest. Like, they may have been there to help, but like this is her quest and he's acknowledging that. And I love that he doesn't try to just take control of the situation and handle it himself. Like, he knows she's the better throw. He knows that she can do this. So he's trusting her to do what she can do.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because I think it goes so far beyond this just being her quest. Percy doesn't care about glory. He really doesn't. I mean, I think a part of him is like, I don't want to be the kid who gets picked on. I would like to be somebody special. But like, at this point in his journey, he's kind of realized the weight of the world is on his shoulders, that very likely he is the one in that prophecy, and he's going to have to make a big decision. And he doesn't want that. Like, that's so much pressure to put on a kid. And so it has nothing to do with glory. It has to do with what is right. And the fact of the matter is, Clarice is a better throw. And he doesn't want to take any chances because it's not about winning. It's not about proving that he's right. It's about making sure it gets done, that they protect Thalia's tree. And if that means handing over the final shot to Clarice, he's going to do it every time. And this time, Clarice doesn't question it. She doesn't say, "You're going to let me win?" She kind of understands that this is about so much more than the quest too, I think, and doesn't hesitate. And boy, does her shot land.
Yes, it does. So yeah, she throws the spear, lodging it into the tree pretty firmly, and connecting the Golden Fleece's magic to the tree. And you literally watch it like flow through the bark, through the branches. The tree instantly starts to heal from Luke's poison and all the damage that had been done by those demigods hacking away at it. The bark starts to peel away, first from the point of Thalia's spear, and just kind of keeps ricocheting backwards until she is freed from the tree. And you hear her yell, "Hear my words, never." She channels one heck of a lightning bolt that hits Percy and a few other people. And then her and Percy, facing each other, both kind of just are spent, and also both just got hit with lightning, and they fall to opposite directions. And it's such a visually interesting way to have this scene end. I actually love that we kind of get a break here in the scene, that they both are kind of knocked out by the lightning, and that's how this scene ends, because I don't think there's anything you could do after that point that would feel like organic. Like, you need them both to kind of be out of commission and for things to end. Luke is basically, you know, done. We'll deal with that later. Like, Thalia appearing from the tree and not necessarily being up to choosing sides right that moment kind of ends this battle.
Yeah, I agree. That camera work with them falling was so cool, so visually interesting. And I just love this like mirror image of them falling and kind of what that implies. And you're right, it's a really good end to that scene before we transition into what is not necessarily an explanation, but a way to kind of get Poseidon involved and kind of tell us what's coming next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Percy is knocked out by this bolt. He finds himself seaside in a slightly different outfit, armor free. And we quickly realize it's a dream or a vision or something. Poseidon even says, like, this is not death. And Percy realizes Poseidon is there too. And so he walks over to his dad and they have a chat about the battles and everything that's lying ahead. We learn that the Titans are loose and that Poseidon is dealing with that. We learn that he is preparing for this battle and that he needs Tyson by his side, making weapons and helping him. And Tyson is instantly on board. He wants that as much as Poseidon does. And I really enjoyed how warm Poseidon was toward Tyson. Yeah. I don't necessarily remember in the book whether they had like a close relationship. I remember him asking Tyson, like, you know, Tyson working in the forges and that. But I really loved in this scene just how warm that relationship came across.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to note, too, that this is the first time Tyson's meeting Poseidon and how interesting that is. But yeah, I love that Tyson just wants to help. You know, I mean, he loves making things, too. So like that probably doesn't hurt. But yeah, he just wants to help his dad.
Well, and he doesn't want to fight. And I think if he stays with Percy, I think he kind of realizes like there will be more fighting and he'll still be there to protect Percy in any way he can. But this is a job he can do, doing things he loves with his dad, who he's just now meeting. Like, that's an offer you don't pass up. So I love this for Tyson because you can tell just how excited he is to be able to help his father. I also love that Poseidon thanked Percy for watching him. And it's like, you should be thanking Sally, but yes, also Percy. And Tyson goes on to thank Poseidon for sending him to Percy and Sally and for giving him a brother when he needed a friend the most. Like, he just wanted a friend and he actually gained a brother and a family. And it's just so cute. And it just goes to show like all the goodness that is Tyson and how much we love him. And it's all illustrated very well in this scene.
Yeah, I tear up literally every time I watch this scene because he's just so genuine about it. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah, so Percy offers his services to Poseidon as well. And
Percy's destiny lies elsewhere. And Poseidon, he tells Percy that he planned to tell him the great prophecy as Percy got closer to 16. But clearly, he's already aware of it. And, you know, he's not apologizing because he's basically saying, like, you're too young to know this stuff. You shouldn't have to be aware of this right now. Like, I know you are. And he's not going to pretend that he doesn't, you know, that Percy doesn't know already. But basically, it was like, I was going to let you be a kid longer. So I'm sorry that you had to find out now. And at that moment, Percy asks if the great prophecy is why Poseidon had him. And I love Poseidon's answer to this. It might be one of my favorite moments in this season, at least in this season, if not the whole show, because Poseidon reminds Percy that there are forces in the world, fate and love, that are greater than a lot of things, but that love might just be greater than anything. And you just get this picture of, you know, Poseidon really has genuine feelings for Sally. It's not just, you know, if he wasn't a god and she wasn't human, they would definitely be together. It's just, you know, their roles in the cosmos that keep them apart. And I really, really love that for the end of this scene because it's just, yeah, Sally's that great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, really, because if you think about it, a lot of times when the gods do have relations with mortals, it's almost like, you know, they covet them. Like, it's like, I shouldn't, this is Zeus I'm thinking of, I shouldn't have it, but I want it, so I'm gonna do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And that gets them into trouble a lot. And I think they've made it very, very clear that that is not the case with Poseidon. This was not, you know, a like fleeting fancy of his. He really does still love Sally so, so much, but because of the circumstances, they can't be together. And that pains him on a level that I think the gods aren't used to feeling, which humanizes him, which makes him somewhat more of a father figure than we see in Zeus, for example.
Or definitely Ares.
Yeah.
So at that moment, Percy wakes up. He's in the infirmary. We learn that Chiron is back. Both Grover and Annabeth tell Percy that he drools in his sleep, and they all have a good laugh about it. And
that was so cute.
I do love that we got a laugh in the end of this season here because the tensions have been so high for like 3 episodes now that we really did need a moment for them to just kind of go, like, we made it through this one. So they survived. Camp survived. Luke has vanished. His forces were driven back and out of camp by everything that went on. I'm pretty sure Thalia freaked a lot of them out. So they're not in camp anymore.
We can assume that Chris is with them now.
I would assume because he outed himself. If anyone else in camp is still secretly on Luke's side, I would imagine they stayed. But yes, anyone who was found out, I would assume is gone.
Yeah.
Clarice isn't going to let him just hang around.
No.
He will knock him out. Yeah, that's right. Chiron put Clarice in charge of preparing troops for the battle ahead. We learn this as they're walking into the big house, Percy, Grover, and Annabeth. And Percy and Clarice have this little standoff that is absolutely picture perfect for the two of them because she's relaying this information to them like, yeah, I'm in charge, you know. And it's almost like she assumes that someone's going to try and fight her on that, but no one would. She is the obvious person to train people. Like, no one's going to fight you on that. But, like, she still doesn't know how to be friends with them and to be friendly. Yeah. And so she's just kind of standing there staring at them awkwardly. And Percy gives her the out and says, just give me a shut up, Jackson. And she does it without the same fire you normally would hear from her. She just kind of says, shut up, Jackson, and walks out. And I just love it because it perfectly illustrates that, like, she is not good at this friend thing, but she's trying to figure it out. And they're all giving her just enough grace to figure it out, to give her the time and the energy to just, she'll get it eventually.
I think my favorite moment in the scene was actually the one between her and Grover, where she was like, you know, Annabeth, you can join me if you want, not you, Grover. And he's like, I'm good. I have my own assignment. And I just love that, like, he's just like, oh, that's just Clarice. Like, it doesn't hurt his feelings. Like, he just knows that, yeah, I mean, that's Clarice, and he's good doing his own thing.
Exactly. It's a nice little friendship they're figuring out here. And I just love all of it. So now we get a moment with our trio and Chiron. And Chiron has a few regrets about how things transpired. He wishes that he had mentioned his connection to Kronos. That is initially why Zeus removed him. He wishes he had told the kids, because he feels like he may have been able to stay on. If they had been aware of it, he could have said, like, everyone knows, or, you know, something like that. He then also goes on to tell them the truth of what happened to Thalia on Half-Blood Hill that night so many years ago. And so we kind of flash it back to that time, and we watch it unfold as Chiron tells the story. So we see that scene from the beginning of the episode again, with Thalia telling Luke and Grover and Annabeth to go into camp to be safe. She'll protect them. She'll hold off the Furies. And we know that Annabeth's memories only show part of what happened. She actually says, like, I've seen this. I don't need to relive it. And Chiron tells her, like, what you remember is different from what happened. Like, there's more to this story. So Chiron was at the base of Half-Blood Hill, looking up at Thalia and the Furies, you know, standing off, like they hadn't started fighting yet. And he was armed with a bow, and he was ready to defend her, to help her. And the Furies didn't attack her. They were having a conversation, and they were talking to her. And we find out that the Furies were bringing a message from Hades, who was trying to drive a wedge between Zeus and Thalia. We don't really hear why necessarily he's trying to drive a wedge, but that was the intention with this. The Furies never did attack. Zeus vaporizes them with a lightning bolt when he realizes what they're up to. He then appears on the hill in front of his daughter. Do we know if this is his first appearance to Thalia? I think it is.
I think it might be too. The way she addresses him is sort of like, I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised. It was like, yeah, most gods don't reveal themselves to their children. Percy is pretty unique in that way.
Like, maybe they've communicated before, but it wasn't like him standing in front of her.
I could see him sending a lackey to communicate with her versus actually going down to, like, see her himself.
Definitely. Okay, so he tries to reason with her. She's nearing 16, and he's trying to kind of relay how important that is and what that means. And he attempts to convince her that she would be revered by the demigods at camp, that she would be, you know, one of the most important people. And she tells Zeus that bringing Luke and Annabeth to camp was clearly a mistake. She doesn't want any part of this. She's going to go get them, and they're going to leave. She has no interest in playing any role in this game that all the gods are playing. And she tells him, I don't want to be your daughter. I will never be your weapon. Do you hear me? Never, which might sound familiar, because that is clearly what came out of her mouth as she left the tree. Chiron saw Zeus turn her into the tree, and Zeus ordered Chiron to lie and to keep the story that the Furies attacked her and Zeus saved her life by changing her into the tree as what happened. And that's what he was allowed to tell people. So this is a huge departure from the books. The story that Chiron was told to tell, that is the truth of what happened in the book. There was an attack. She protected. Zeus turned her into a tree. That was what happened. So I'm really intrigued by how they're kind of manipulating this here. Clearly, they're turning this, it's more of a complicated situation than just Zeus saving his daughter's life and trying to keep her around. I'm interested to see how this continues to affect the story going forward.
Yeah, I'm really glad that they did this, actually, because even though it's a departure, I think you're right, it does complicate the story in a good way. Because not only are they clearly setting up Thalia as somebody who could potentially be an antagonist, which definitely is going to cause complications for Annabeth and Percy's relationship, and also just in general with the story until she eventually joins the Hunters, but it also paints Zeus in a worse light than he was painted in the books. And that's also good for this story, because I think it's really important to show how different Poseidon is as a father from Zeus. It's important to show that Zeus doesn't like Percy, doesn't really have those warm, squishy feelings, because by the time we do get to book five and Zeus has to essentially give Percy what he's asking for, that's going to mean so much more than, you know, if he was kind of low key a good guy all along. I just like this idea that, like, he's supposed to be this Olympian god who is technically one of the good guys if the bad guys are Cronos and the Titans, but he's also kind of a jerk at the same time. And I will say, Courtney B. Vance, fantastic job.
Yep.
And I know that we're all super sad about Lance, and Lance is always going to be the Zeus of my heart. But I was watching Courtney B. Vance really closely to see what he was doing with the character. And I have to say, the way he spoke brought to the table the same kind of gravitas and musicality that Lance brought when he was playing Zeus. And, like, I really appreciated that. I feel like he made it his own, but he also was, like, doing an echo of what Lance was doing.
Which I think is the perfect way to kind of walk that road right now. Like, mm-hmm. We only really have that one scene of Lance as Zeus, but it was impactful. So mm-hmm. If Courtney can now walk that road, and every scene of Zeus will put it will put Lance's Zeus a little further from our minds. But this first scene, seeing him as Zeus, it almost has to kind of straddle the line between Lance's version and what he is going to be doing as Zeus. You need to be able to see both in that portrayal. And yes, I agree with you. I think he did a great job. I'm very much looking forward to seeing him as Zeus some more, and also interested to see, like, Toby Stevens and Courtney B. Vance as Zeus and Poseidon. Like, because I'm intrigued to see how they measure up. Lance and Toby were really intense, and I really loved their scene together. So, like, I'm excited to see in the future the two of them in one room, like, how that feels and how that tension works. So,
yeah. And Courtney's got the intensity down, so I'm really not too worried about it.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Okay, so as Chiron is ending his story, Thalia walks through the doors of the big house, which is very reminiscent of how the cloaked figure walked through the doors in Percy's dream. So mm-hmm. it very much echoes what he was dreaming, and I love that. She sees Annabeth and can't believe Annabeth has grown as much as she has. Annabeth kind of rushes forward to hug Thalia. And then Thalia starts asking where Luke is. And that's the last physical, like, diegetic sound in the scene that we hear, is Thalia repeating, "Where is Luke? Where is Luke?" And so we get her and Percy standing on opposite sides of the room, just kind of sizing each other up. And then we get this voiceover from Percy, and he says, "You guys get nightmares, right? Not like mine, because mine just woke up." And scene.
That is a great line and a great way to end the season. Like, it sucks because obviously I want more immediately, but like, that is a great, like, oh no, what's going to happen next? Tune in next time.
Right. But yeah, such a great way to end it. A final scene. You do get the Thalia Percy, like, standoff. You get them in the same room, but without giving either a chance to start talking, to start the fight or discussion or whatever's about to happen, just leaves you with that much more anticipation for season three, which we know is coming later this year. And I really loved how they did this. I loved how they set it up. I loved the voiceover. Like, I just think they really ended this episode in a great way, and the season as a whole too. So the credits start there, and then we get this little bonus scene. Percy and Annabeth are dressed up in their, you know, school dance finery, and they walk into a winter dance together. And then Annabeth drags Percy onto the dance floor and makes him dance. And then we find out that season three is coming this year. I also just have to point out her dress has like scalloped, scaly look on it, like almost like a mermaid's tail. And I just loved that was what they went with. I'm like, oh my gosh.
I immediately thought of a mermaid too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It definitely is leading us to, yeah, to some of that stuff for sure. But yeah, such a cute little random bonus scene. No lines, no nothing, just them at the dance looking awkward. And I'm not sure what this is supposed to signify, but I'm intrigued to see how this scene works into season three, for sure. And then after the credits, we do also get a post-credits scene, which is worth, it's short, but it's worth mentioning. Cersei has started an accelerated course on her island, and she debuts two new statues, and they are of Percy and Annabeth. So she is once again still on her stuff, and she's taking credit for them surviving, and she's doing her thing.
Yeah, I literally just watched that while you were talking like 20 seconds ago, because I didn't realize there was a second one. Like, obviously, I saw the first one. Then I was like, oh, clearly that's it. I should know better watching Marvel movies all the time. Always stay through all of the credits. But that was really awesome. And her looking to the camera and winking, what? Like, what does that mean? But yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah, it's just a perfect little cap. Like, oh, yep, she's still doing what she does. Like, yeah. I don't know if we'll see Cersei again. Like, I know we'll see Calypso, but I don't know if we see Cersei again, but it's a funny way to kind of cap the season for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have a next time. I mean, we got the little dance scene, but that's as much as we know about season three. I did have just three little questions that kind of popped up to me right at the end here, so I'll throw them out there. We'll get through them quick. How are they going to use Thalia now that her story has been adjusted a little bit? I'm curious if there will be some, like, will she kind of take stock of what's going on and weigh her options for whether Luke or Percy is better to follow? Will she immediately kind of join Annabeth's side because Annabeth is literally standing there holding on to her? Or, like, I'm curious how that is all going to shape up next year.
Mm-hmm. I really think that they're, yeah, this year. I really think that they're going to use Thalia's presence to drive a wedge between Annabeth and Percy. I think, you know, they need to go through trials and tribulations in their relationship before they can end up as strong as they are at the end. And this is just another one. I do think there will be a little bit of a will she, won't she in terms of joining Luke or not. But I kind of have a feeling they're not going to hammer it home like super hard, because I think ultimately, yes, Thalia doesn't like Zeus and doesn't want to do anything to help him. But even worse than that, she's not going to want to help Kronos. So I'm hoping they don't drag it out too long.
Yeah, I would be fine with an episode or two of her, like, debating it and thinking about her options and, you know, maybe even having like an Iris message conversation with Luke or something, trying to figure out where he actually lies and not just believing Percy because he's standing with Annabeth. Like, mm-hmm. I would be interested to see how she kind of goes about that. My other question was, did Zeus keep the secret from the other gods, or was this just a secret from like the demigods and camp? Like, Chiron was told to keep the secret, but like, has he been keeping it from literally everyone that like Hades tried to drive a wedge between them and he put Thalia in a tree to stop it, or to stop her from leaving? Or has he, are the gods aware of what he's been doing and it's just kind of an on earth situation where they didn't want the truth getting out?
Yeah, I would almost think the gods would be aware because they are like not fully like omnipotent, but like close to it. Like they do know more than what they just physically like see themselves. So I wouldn't be super surprised if the gods knew this and also just didn't talk about it.
Right. It doesn't really involve them, so I don't see why they would care. But like, I'm curious whether this has been a huge secret for everything or if it was just like, we're not telling the campers that this is what's gone on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, are there any other story points that carry over from season two to season three that we're excited to see play out? There wasn't anything else I could think of. I mean, we kind of talked about the Chris Rodriguez of it all and like Clarice continuing down, you know, the new having friends side of Clarice and all that. So there wasn't anything that really jumped out at me. I am, of course, excited to hopefully see Beckendorf and start the ball rolling on some of that. So, mm-hmm. But yeah. Okay. We also have the last episode of the Percy Jackson and the Olympians official podcast to talk about. We're going to try and kind of just run through this because it was a lot of Arian and Walker just kind of sitting around like boys talking.
Yeah.
And it was very cute. And I think it's worth a watch just to kind of see them together and having a fun convo. But there's not a ton of like brand new life-changing information in here. So we're just going to kind of scroll right through it here. Walker and Arian, he, you know, welcomes his friend to the show, and Arian admits to Walker that he auditioned for Percy, and we got to see his audition tape, which was really cute.
He's so young in it. My God.
So young. And I kind of love how it was framed, like, he was talking to Grover, so he had to say Grover's name a couple of times, and, like, they were talking, like, about the monsters like they were Mythomagic characters, but also like Percy wanted to go fight a monster and Grover was telling him like that's not a good idea. Like, it was a cute way to kind of frame the scene, but yeah, it was weird hearing him talk to Grover instead of being Grover.
Mm-hmm.
totally strange. Arian does go on to thank everyone involved in both the show and the podcast, including us for watching and all of that. He had a great time doing the podcast. I'm curious if they'll continue doing it next year. I would assume. But yeah. I also really want that behind the scenes doc stuff that we got last year. So like, I kind of hope, you know, if it's one or the other, like, I don't know. I want both. So
yeah, let's
work on
me too.
He invites Walker on for his actual segment, and they talk a lot about the fighting and the fight sequence. Walker goes into talking about how they're really setting up the violence. We kind of talked about this before, but like, they are very aware of how violent and hyper-violent the series gets as it goes on, and they are very carefully constructing it so that it's like baby-stepping through that, which I thought was really... Oh, good thought and well handled by the team and the creative team and all that. Arian didn't really get to see much of the fight, and we obviously, they didn't get to see each other on set very much, but they live next door to each other, so they saw each other all the time, which is just cute.
I loved how they were like, and we're totally gonna like hang out after we're done doing this. Like, they really are best friends in real life, and that translates so well on screen.
It does.
By the way, I got mad Posey and Dylan O'Brien vibes from them, where like,
yes.
I mean, the two of them still talk all the time. They're still really close. Like, the fact that they became so close on Teen Wolf and then these two. And then I was thinking like, Walker could play a young Dylan O'Brien, like his little brother in something. And I would kill to see that, man.
He totally could. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That would be, oh, that'd be cute. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe someday. We'll have to keep our fingers crossed. They reflect on Percy's speech in the big house and talk about how this is just Percy's first touch at leadership and how that is just going to continue to get more and more intense as the series goes on. And I really loved them kind of laying that out and that, again, that they're thinking about it. It's just the intention. It's mm-hmm. that the show is looking at this as a 5-season show, that they're looking to make Percy's growth so well established that they are keeping track of not just Arian's horn length and, you know, remember that from a couple episodes back.
Yeah.
But they're also tracking, you know, Percy's leadership style and everything else. So, yeah, I just love the intentionality they're showing with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
They also go on to talk about Walker's love for the books, which we is well established. We know a lot about how much Walker loves Percy. And Walker kind of talked about how he talks to himself the way Percy talks to himself. And he credits reading the book really young kind of as the impetus for that, because it kind of taught him the tone he wanted to use in his own head, which I think is hilarious. And of course, Walker likes that the series gets darker as it goes. When he first read the series, his younger self didn't realize that the kissing was like emotionally driven and that it was like a plot point. He thought it was just like, oh, they just wanted to kiss. That's it.
I saw people in the comments on this episode going, how very Percy Jackson of him to not understand what that means.
It's right. It's so perfect because Percy is just so oblivious. And it's exactly how Walker was describing it. It's perfection. But yeah, they go on to talk about what being on the show meant to them and the cast and how much they just love the opportunities they've been given. And it's nice to hear them be so grateful for everything the show has really provided. So then Toby Stevens calls in, and this was not a surprise because after last episode, we kind of expected him to show up at some point. Mm-hmm. First of all, apparently he smells amazing. Many people on set agree with this and have asked Toby, and Toby's given them the name of the cologne, and they all have bought it and they all smell the same. And so they walk by each other and they're like, oh, you're wearing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, my goodness. So now
it's way too long on this. It right? was kind of weird.
If you are ever near enough to Toby Stevens, I mean, apparently he smells great and he is not offended by that. He said, hey, at least I smell good. Like, thanks, guys. Yeah. They did spend a lot of time talking about it. It was really funny. They also talk about the Poseidon and Tyson meeting. And Toby was really excited to meet Daniel and really enjoyed the scene with all of them. He liked seeing the brothers together. He thought that was a really great moment. And Walker talks about how scenes with Poseidon are a chance to slow down on the show. That everything is so hyper, fast-paced, action-y that he knows when he has a scene coming up with Poseidon that it's going to be pulled back and it's going to be them standing and talking. And, you know, he really looks forward to those scenes because he knows he's going to have a chance to just kind of sink into the moment with Toby. So I really loved that. They also talk about Poseidon as a dad. Arian specifically asked, does he see Zeus and Ares and see their parenting styles and adjust accordingly? And Toby talks about how Poseidon genuinely loves Sally and Percy, and he thinks that that just makes the huge difference from how Zeus and Ares see their children. He truly loves these people, and if he was not a god, would be there with them every day living a happy life. And it's just because he's a god that he, you know, has to kind of look down on them and only be a part of their lives when the opportunity presents itself. So, yeah, I loved hearing that from him and knowing that that's where he's coming from with the character too. He kind of admitted that Poseidon maybe did have a hand in directing Tyson toward Percy and Sally. It wasn't just kismet. Tyson kind of prayed for intervention for someone to send him a friend. And Poseidon did kind of hear that and kind of put him in the path of Percy and Sally. And I kind of love that because he gave the brothers each other, which is really cute. They do talk a little bit about season one, which I thought was kind of funny since we've basically done and buried season one. But there was some talk about Lance that was really sweet to hear. So definitely worth watching for. They also talk, and I thought this was a really interesting part of the podcast discussion. They talk about how playing a god is like, you can't walk around like thinking you're a god, that you have to, when you're playing a god in a show like this, you just have to try and give him the weight he deserves and then let everyone around the character act like he's a god. Because if you try to portray him as a god, you end up just looking like a caricature and ridiculous. And I really loved them kind of laying all that out. I wouldn't have thought of that.
I think that's really reflective of what the Greek gods stood for in the first place. They did have human traits. They were fallible. They did make mistakes and do kind of crazy things. And there's a reason why all of those stories exist. And it's to make them relatable so that they could teach people lessons and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Toby's son is a huge fan of the books and was very excited that his dad was going to get to be on the show, which I loved. We also learned that Toby's stepfather wrote the original screenplay for the original Clash of the Titans, which was the story of Perseus. So that there's kind of a little of a familial connection to.
Yeah. This man, my goodness. he's like acting royalty.
He really kind of is. It's crazy. And then, like Toby loves working with Walker. We actually got to see Walker do an impression of Toby as Poseidon, and Virginia Call recorded it. And it was really funny and cute. So again, worth watching for that. They do specifically talk about Lance and Courtney B. Vance and the difference of working with both of them. And it was nice to hear that, like, Toby really loved working with Lance and was looking forward to more. And now working with Courtney instead, and just, you know, he's looking forward to having scenes with Courtney in the future and seeing how the dynamic changes. That was really neat. So then that Toby basically pieces out. Arian and Walker talk a little bit about Thalia and then get into some season 3 talk, which I'm just going to run through the things they said because it was a lot of like bits and bobs of things that they could share. So at the time that they recorded the podcast, they were working on episode 3 of season 3. So they are making their way. They've made their way through the first 2 episodes. Olive and Levi, who are playing Bianca and Nico respectively, are doing very well. They just got drenched for the first time, which is apparently a rite of passage for every demigod on Percy Jackson. Walker talks about, now it's just him, Olive, and Levi in classes on set, that Leah has graduated, and so she doesn't have to take classes anymore, and he hates it because he has a hard time going in and out of school and work stuff. He wishes he could just work like everyone else, especially now that Arian and Leah aren't doing classes anymore. And so, he hates that Olive and Levi are really, really good at transitioning from school to work and back again, and he resents it. It's kind of cute. Both Arian and Walker love the guy playing Thorn. He is apparently really great at it, and they love scenes with him, and he is just intense and really funny, so love that.
And lots of great improvisation, which I'm hoping that makes it into the show, or at least the behind-the-scenes stuff, because I love when they do things like that. They, like, show the different jokes that could have made it in. That would be really cool.
Agreed. So much agreed. Arian / Grover get to play the panpipes, and we got to see a little bit of behind the scenes as Arian was learning to play them. So that's good fun. We found out that Arian and Walker watched the first movie together. They had like a movie night and watched it, and then watched the whole first season of the show together just to kind of take in the whole picture of what they're doing. And I just thought that was adorable, that was something they wanted to take time doing. Arian's time with the camera department made him appreciate how hard those jobs are. He was apparently completely exhausted by the end of that week, and he says that they have the easiest jobs on set. Like, he was like, guy, we've got it good. Like, we can't complain. Like, yeah. So it was really cute.
When actors hype up the crew. That always makes me so happy. Yeah.
Again, it's another reason I love that they're letting the kids kind of sit in on other crew jobs when they don't have a lot of scenes, because there's so much they can learn and so much to be appreciative of, and seeing all the work that goes into it is just going to make them better people and better actors. So I love that. The last thing, Walker was talking about how fighting Clarice on the beach at the beginning of season 2 was a really interesting way to show his progress, because when you saw him fight her in season one, he had absolutely zero skill. And he kind of really talked about how that scene, and like, that was one of his favorite scenes of season two, which is funny because it's such a small kind of nothing mm-hmm. throwaway thing, but he loves kind of tracking Percy's progress. And that was a real big marker for him. So
yeah,
that pretty much wraps up the podcast coverage. Again, they talked about so much and they babbled in and out of things, and they were just basically friends hanging out, and then had Toby on as well to kind of hang out too. And it was really nice to see them as friends kind of just chatting through. And Arya even said, like, this is so weird because you're my best mm-hmm. friend, and why are we sitting here doing an interview? Like, I don't know how to interview you. Like, this is weird. So I highly recommend watching the podcast because it is a great time and a little more time that you get to spend with the actors behind these characters. And yeah, so we are officially a wrap on Percy Jackson season two. And now we just wait for, I'm assuming, December for season three, I think, is when we're supposed to expect it.
I think but so, definitely which is this really year. Exciting.
Yes, I am super glad that we're getting it this year. That is, I'm glad they're not trying to hold it or something. Like, I'm glad that they're pushing forward and keeping the timeline kind of intact. So that's really cool. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Instagram at Prophecy Radio Podcast or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really, really appreciate it. You can leave us questions, comments, or ideas for content you want to hear in our episodes. We love hearing from you guys. We are looking forward to getting into all the news. So if you're really excited about any of the news that's come out recently, please reach out. Let us know how you feel about the casting or the announcement for season three or anything that you've heard so far. Feel free to send us a link if there's a specific article or something that has you excited. And we're looking forward to wrapping things up and catching up on all the news soon. So
yeah.
All right. Until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out. Five minutes shy of 9 o'clock.
I'm still dying, Kristen. Did you see how many times I blew my nose?
Yes, I did.
Oh my God. Like, I need to sneeze so bad and it just won't come out. It hurts.
Oh, I hate that.
This might be the last time you ever see me. If I go eat dinner and die, this is my, like, you're going to have to edit this episode.
That will be really rough and I will be very sad. But rest assured, I would edit it and make sure that your last moments of peace before the pineapple took you would be immortalized forever. I promise.
I love that.